We are about to embark on a journey with a dynamic individual that many might find surprising. McDonald's leadership, stewardship, and innovation are mind-blowing. Their partnership with the Environmental Defense Fund has been nothing short of amazing and has led the way for the fast food industry to take many different, more sustainable paths in a myriad of areas. Welcome to an insider's glimpse at McDonald's leadership in the areas of corporate social involvement and sustainability for over 25 years. Hello, I'm Gina Murphy-Darling, and this is Mrs. Green's World. McDonald's battle to do good, the Inside Edition. Are you ready for it? Because that is just what this is going to be about. Joining me to just share his story is a man named Bob Langert. Bob led McDonald's corporate social responsibility and sustainability efforts for more than 25 years. And everybody, like, press pause, think about that. That was like, to me, I don't even know if I knew how to spell sustainability, but I didn't care about it 25 years ago. And that's my honest admission. But he did. And he worked there for 25 years before retiring in 2015. Currently, he has another life. He is a columnist and editor at large for the Green Biz Group, one of my favorite in the country, and senior sustainability advisor for the Context Network, the premier global and agribusiness consulting firm in advancing agriculture. He is also author of the book, a lot of which this show is based on, The Battle to Do Good, Inside McDonald's Sustainability Journey. So, Bob, that was a long introduction, but it's so great that I got to meet you and your wife at Green Biz and to now have you all to myself for the next hour. What a pleasant opportunity for me and hopefully a good journey for you.
Well, it's special to see you in person, and I could talk about sustainability all day long, so watch out, Gina.
I know, I'm ready. Like, that's what I said, it's a podcast, we have no end. I love, since we went to the podcast format, we don't have some music interrupting me. So there really is so much I want to ask you, and you do really have so much information to share that I think will really surprise a lot of people like it did me, and I think it'll be of great interest to our listeners. Your journey, how you got to be at McDonald's, to me, is the first place to start. Then we'll talk about McDonald's sustainability journey and all that entailed, some insights from your book, and hopefully we'll have time to discuss your thoughts on McDonald's impact on the industry as a whole. So we'll weave in and out and hopefully cover lots of territory. So the best place to start, I have to ask this question. How does an international brand that produces hamburgers, why does it matter to them and to you that they are so committed, and they were so committed to moving the green needle forward? That, to me, is the big, bold question. It was move it forward in sustainable, impactful ways that have had tremendous impacts on the industry and the planet. So that's the big picture question. Why did it matter? You make hamburgers.
Well, you know, I think the question of why changed over time. You know, really, at the beginning, when I first was given a temporary assignment. I mean, I got in this by a fluke. You know, McDonald's was under attack for producing too much waste. You remember the polystyrene clamshell? It was a symbol of evilness and running out of landfill space. And for the first time ever, McDonald's was considered to be kind of Ronald McToxic. That was a magazine cover that still sticks with me. So this is all in the late 80s. And there's nobody to work on this at McDonald's. And somebody just picked me out. I used to be in charge of truck drivers, believe it or not. And thank goodness this person, George Macko, I'm forever thankful, he saw something in me to give me this job of saving the polystyrene clamshell and kind of beginning the whole journey, as many companies have. And so the why back then in the late 80s was, hey, we're under attack by society. We're being accused of being irresponsible, producing too much waste. So the why back then was defensive. It was reactive. Nothing wrong with that in a sense that so many things in society for business is reacting what's going around you. But I would say the why changed over time to be much more thoughtful and strategic. And we can talk about that more. And I think that's where so many companies need to be. And McDonald's ended up being there. It took us probably longer than we should have to develop our strategic framework for sustainability and develop 2020 goals. We did that in 2014. So that's what I write about, this journey from a lot of the theme of the book is a theme of going from defensiveness to being proactive.
That's huge. I mean, that's really huge. And, but we have to, we cannot in any way, shape, or form gloss over your journey, because I loved hearing that story. You were in charge of fleet and traffic. I mean, that's huge. The trucks are a big deal. And then you took a 6-month gig to help save the styrofoam. And wasn't it to save the styrofoam, if my notes were my memory correctly? So tell us a little bit about your journey, because that was just the beginning of a new beginning.
Well, in my beginning was like the greatest beginning ever. I feel like I went to the Harvard of sustainability, because right at the get-go, my boss said, "Hey, Bob, you're in charge of this partnership that we created with the Environmental Defense Fund." And it was the first. Now, you have to imagine, back in 1990, there were no really big partnerships between big brands and companies and a powerful environmental group. So I think today it's more standard, but still it's unique. So back then, it made a lot of headlines when this was announced. "We let the wolf into the hen house," is what one of the magazines said. So my boss said, "Hey, you're in charge of this deal." We had a team of 4 people from McDonald's. There's a team of 3 or 4 people from the Environmental Defense Fund. And that's when I learned so many good things. Now, I have to admit, I didn't know the Environmental Defense Fund, and I wouldn't have defined myself as an environmentalist back then. We can talk more about that later. I cared about issues of the world, but that's not how I defined myself. And I looked at these people coming in without any knowledge, and I had a stereotype. I had a stereotype that they're tree huggers. They're not going to really care about the McDonald's business. They're going to be impractical. They're going to be pie in the sky and all that. And from the very first minute I met them, it just turned around. These were smart, savvy, sophisticated people. They were willing to roll up their sleeves. They worked in our restaurants. They learned our business. And yes, they were fierce advocates for reducing waste. But part of our agreement was they couldn't change the very nature of our restaurant. We still need to be fast food. We're not going to be like a fine dining restaurant. And they lived up to that promise. And I think Fred Krupp with the Environmental Defense Fund is, he could be the greatest leader of our generation, Gina. He's led the Environmental Defense Fund since the mid-80s. I'm sorry, the mid-80s.
Yeah.
And he changed EDF. You know, their motto used to be "Sue the bastards."
I was going to put that in. It's a great line.
So many of the environmental groups, it's antagonistic. And he went to school. He listened to this Professor Walker, and he said, you know, we could lower our voices and collaborate with companies and have greater impact. And his first experiment, which was a great experiment, was him kind of proposing this for McDonald's. And McDonald's, we were desperate for getting out of this evilness of being a cause for too much waste. You know, we didn't know what to do. So, hey, we agreed to it. And it was just the greatest experience, because I found that the people were great and nice. They became my friends. And so this idea that the enemy can be your friend is something I learned. That the fact that you can come up, we came up with 42 ways to reduce, reuse, recycle in our business, all of which we implemented. We reduced 300 million pounds during the decade of the 90s. It didn't really cost us a penny more. A lot of this stuff saved us money. For instance, we took an inch off the napkin. Well, that reduces 3 million tons of waste a year, and obviously less resources, we save money.
Who came up with that? Like, just, I mean, we gloss over these things in these interviews, and I listen back to them like, you took an inch off a napkin. Who would think that? First of all, who would miss it? You know what I mean? Like, I didn't know that McDonald's napkins were 1 inch shorter. And then say it again, what the impact was in terms of waste reduction and energy reduction. What was the impact for that one big decision? It's a lot of napkins.
3 million tons of waste.
Jeez, Louise. Yeah.
Yeah, well, that just tells you the scale. I mean, obviously, McDonald's is huge. I mean, today, McDonald's has got 37 restaurants. So when you reduce 1 inch, can you imagine all the napkins that are used?
3,700 restaurants? Is that?
37,000,
right? 37,000. I was going to say, yeah, 37,000. That's a big number.
Multiply all those daily napkins by
that 1 inch. Times that number, yeah. Yeah. But let's go a little bit deeper into the EDF relationship, because from what I could tell, you know, like from the Sue the Bastards conversation, there was a transformation for Fred as the president, because he was turned off at a lot of big businesses and major corporations. until McDonald's. And he said that on the stage at Green Biz. And he didn't go in with his team expecting open arms and high praise and kumbaya. But once he started working with McDonald's, he knew that this was a real commitment and that it came from leadership, that there was going to be buy-in, that it wasn't some sustainability officer like Bob Langert trying to make things happen. How did that impact, or was there a predisposition on the part of McDonald's leadership in terms of their approach to partnerships? Was it good to begin with?
Well, we didn't have a history of knowing this.
So this was the first.
Yeah. Big so this one. this was kind of, you know, this is out of left field. So I still remember us talking like we don't know what we're getting into. And my boss, a great person, Shelby Astro, he was general counsel of the company, and he was a very creative mind. And he's the one that made this decision. And he went out on a limb, and you know, he had to trust the top management. He knew we were in trouble. And he had this theory, which is a fantastic theory, that you need to work with a third party, you need to open up your doors and let them in and actually do these tangible changes. So Shelby was the one that gave me the direction to work on this and give it a gamble. And we thought it was worth it because we were, again, in such a dire straits. I mean, I can't tell you how we all felt about being attacked daily as having too much waste. I don't think people realize today that there was headlines all over the world back then that were running out of landfill space. Now, since then, we found out really that's not the case, not to defend landfills. I think they're the worst things in the world. But the fact is, there is a lot of room for garbage, and that's another issue, another problem. But back then, you know, we were really, we went in blind. And to our benefit, you had Shelby, my boss, who gave kind of permission for all this to happen in McDonald's. You had Fred. Now, Fred was probably under even more pressure from his environmental peers because it was not any way a way of doing environmental work back then to actually partner with a company. Almost all the work was, let's attack them.
Advocacy,
let's figure out
yes,
some way to kill.
Yes, agitate, yep.
So, you know, he took a gamble and a lot of pot shots were given to Fred and the Environmental Defense Fund, but Fred stuck to it. And he always thought, which came to be true, that if he could deliver the results, which he did, I just spoke about the results, that people would see the wisdom of the ways. And so I think kudos to Fred and groups like the Environmental Defense Fund that are willing to take some risks and partner with companies on these tough issues, because companies can't do it alone. I just described how we didn't know anything about packaging and waste. I mean, so here I am assigned to this. I know nothing about it. So you have to bring in outside experts. Almost every company has to do that. So I think we got lucky to get Fred, to get his team.
I agree. I totally agree. And, you know, you told stories, and I was just thinking now I actually know someone that could get us Fred for a podcast, because now I know Bob Langert and there's a trail to Fred, because that would be another great show. But there were things that were just so amusing, and not just amusing, but interesting to learn. Like, you actually took their staff to the locations, to the back of the house, because some of the recommendations they made were crazy and not practical and weren't going to happen. And the telling part of that to me is they saw it. You couldn't use real dishes at McDonald's. Just the thought of it makes my head spin. Like, that is not a thing that's going to work and have your, you know, there's a compacted space. But those stories, I mean, I felt like I am getting an inside look at McDonald's, because that doesn't make sense to me. You can't use plates and glasses at McDonald's. It doesn't make sense at all.
Yeah, they came in and they definitely thought we should be switching to more reusable dishes and reusable utensils. But they were, again, even though they were fairly, I'll call it determined.
Right.
At that point, they were also determined to be open-minded.
Right, right.
I said, hey, let's go observe all these things.
See what that would look like. Yeah.
Now,
right.
I kind of knew what we would see, but, you know, you never know. And, you know, we saw two things. One is, you know, we see, you know, first of all, McDonald's only serves in the United States 25% of the business is eat in. So you're dealing with a very smaller portion of business.
Right.
And then even the people that sit down and eat, they don't finish their drinks a lot of times, or they don't finish their food. They want to take it out with them.
Right.
So there goes your dishes.
And it just didn't make sense at all, like at all. But to me, the telling part of that story is you showed them instead of saying no. You said, well, come here and look and tell us how you think that might work. And they found out very clearly it wouldn't. But what about, you know, there were times, and I tried to find it in my notes. I was taking copious notes and still trying to pay attention when you did your presentation. But there were times, and it's mentioned in the book, when things did cost money and you still got the green light. Can you give some, you know, I remember you saying something to my boss, just said, how much is it going to cost? And you told him and he said, well, just do it. Weren't there stories, because there were price, you know, real dollars to spend a time to implement some of these changes. Do I have that story straight in my head? Or
yeah,
did I make it up?
No, you really do. One of the next big things I worked on was animal welfare issues. And, long story short, we really dug into how eggs are produced, you know, from laying hens. And we were under attack a lot from PETA, other animal rights groups, that the treatment of the hens was just barbaric, that they're in these cages. So again, to this idea that we just talked about, Gina, you know, show me. I want to see what this is all about. I just don't want to read about it. I don't trust everything I read. And I want to go see it, smell it, hear it, talk to the people around it, et cetera. So I went to some egg facilities and got to see the real deal. And I'm not a big fan of PETA and some of their tactics. They can be pretty over the top.
Right.
But on the other hand, you know, sometimes the issue they're actually promulgating, you know, is a legitimate issue. So I looked at the laying hens and said, man, they're cramming seven hens into a cage that, you know, doesn't even fit on half the top of your desk. And I thought it was very, very wrong. And this is one advantage to not being a scientist. I'm a layperson that looks through this through kind of a generalist eye. So it doesn't look right to me. I didn't like it. And I brought that back to the company. None of us liked it. I'm leading up to why this costs money. So obviously when we asked our suppliers, we had 27 egg suppliers in the United States at the time. This is about 2000 or so. And so we ended up saying we got to double the size of the cages and increase the room that they have to move, which is a very big announcement at that time. Now, since then, that's been dwarfed by McDonald's and others going cage-free. But again, incrementally, that was a big move back then. And believe it or not, our suppliers didn't want to do it. All 27 of them refused to do business with McDonald's. So we had to find another supplier to do all of our egg business. But I remember making the decision. We had calculated that it was going to cost $17 million a year, which is a lot of money. And even for McDonald's, that's big-time money. And I had this discussion with the chief of our supply chain, Tom Albrecht, and I remember being with Tom in the hallway. I said, Tom, here's the facts. Here's what it's going to cost, $17 million. He just looked right up to me. He says, you know what? This is the right thing to do. Let's just do it. And that's what I heard so often. And I know your audience may not believe it, that the fact that in my company, I worked there for many, many years because I liked it. And the first question that usually was asked in all these problems that we had is, what was the right thing to do? And I like that. And it touches me to think that we made other decisions like that that cost money, and we don't go out and tell anybody about it. We just do it.
And, you know, here's what I want to say to that, because guess what? Wait till you hear the close to my show. When we got your book, I'm being honest, I was like, really? Wow. McDonald's and sustainability, and I end up in the end of the show, I promise you, it's kind of like shame on me, because stereotypes and not knowing the facts are never a good path to follow. So to my listeners who are having a visceral reaction, I say to them, if you met Bob Langert, case closed, because you can tell about your integrity, your honesty, your gentle spirit, your intelligence. And read the book, folks, because I did. And I'm going to skip around from what my notes say, but it's perfect, because the battle for the Amazon rainforest. Now, I started my journey of Mrs. Green in the rainforest. So like that chapter jumped out at me. It's chapter 9. And I want to read the beginning. It's a couple of sentences. Eating up the Amazon. As a kid from the asphalt alleys, concrete sidewalks, and blocks of bungalows facing the east side of south side of Chicago, I never dreamed I would have a hand in saving a piece of the Amazon, but I did. And in that, chapter, it talks about Greenpeace and the chickens, and I'm reading about the river dolphins because I saw them on my journey. So I think that's a chapter that you should talk about quite a bit more, because Greenpeace became allies in many ways as well. Is that fair to say? I mean, you shook hands with them, literally, and good things came out of it. So tell us about that chapter. It's one of the ones that I have a big red sticky on and says, oh gosh, you have to make sure Bob talks about everything in there. And there's a lot, so take as long as you need.
Well, it was absolutely one of my favorite things I ever worked on. Let me tell you how it started and kind of how we got over the hurdle, because I have to admit, you know, when I woke up, I think it was April 16th, 2006, I opened up my BlackBerry and I find out that Greenpeace is attacking McDonald's, that they're showing up in dozens of restaurants in the United Kingdom dressed up in chicken suits. And I dig in more and I realize they sent out a report that day called Eating Up the Amazon. And so I figured, okay, I'm going to be real busy this day. And at the time, I didn't...
Did you think about going back to bed and taking the phone off the hook? Because that's, you don't want Greenpeace after you.
No, to be honest with you, I get an adrenaline rush with all this stuff because I go,
Thank goodness, this is another
opportunity. Let me figure this out. On the other hand, I have to say my impression of Greenpeace was not positive. I had interfaced with Greenpeace at various times in my career. And for the most part, I kind of labeled them. Again, I don't like the label either, but in my mind, I go, well, they're a campaigning organization. They're not really interested in results and working together collaboratively. So I called up my friends at Conservation International. I called up my friends at the World Wildlife Fund, which, by the way, to me is really important as a corporate sustainability leader to have relationships already with people that you trust.
Right, and
you,
trusted like partners. Those are two good examples. I mean, Conservation International, another one of my, you know, their heroes.
Yeah, you know, so I read the report, but to be honest with you, I read it, I go, well, is it really the truth or not? So I call them up. I learned within one day, the same day, I learned that basically the report was correct. So again, don't like the fact that they're showing up in our restaurants, you know, kind of doing their campaigning and embarrassing McDonald's to a certain degree. On the other hand, I found out that the issue was legitimate. And by the way, real quickly, the issue was that there's too much soy being grown in Brazil.
Right, because we have to tie it back to the chickens. Right.
Yeah, it's infringing. They're tearing down the Amazon rainforest to grow more soy. Brazil is the breadbasket of the world, you know, practically. Much of it is exported elsewhere, including to Europe. So they export soy to Europe, and it's... soy is the main ingredient for chicken feed that goes into products like chicken McNuggets. So there you have your linkage. And so when, you know, later on I learned, you know, hey, Greenpeace, why do you attack us, not Cargill, who's more responsible for the soy than us? But who knows Cargill? How can you get attention by campaigning? They can get attention by campaigning against McDonald's. So anyway, I learned very quickly that the issue is legitimate. I thought about it further, talked to some of my teammates at McDonald's that very same day and said, well, you know, we already had a policy in the company that we're not going to use recently beef from recently deforested areas of the Amazon and other rainforest areas. So I go, even though we're not a big part of this issue, we figured that our suppliers maybe use 0.1% of the soy that's involved in this. So it's a little bit of a symbolic move. But on the other hand, all the users of soy, that's just the way the food business is. There are no big, big users of soy. It's disaggregated like that. So we said, you know what? We agree with Greenpeace. I called them up, I think the same day, maybe it was the next day. And our team said, hey, Greenpeace, I later learned that we shot the living daylights out of them because...
I bet you did. They weren't expecting cooperation.
They didn't expect me to say. So one of the first things I said to them is, we agree with your report. We agree with your findings. Great job. And I took the air out of their campaign, because how can you campaign against a company when the company says, well, we agree with you? Okay, so that's step number one. But the second part of that discussion was much tougher. And this is where I think a lot of companies, you got to have the courage. Because a lot of the companies, they don't have the courage to kind of stand up for what the real solution is. So Greenpeace had sent us five demands. And it was by fax back then. And these five demands were ridiculous.
Like they were big demands. I read them and I underlined them. It's like, yeah, this is a thing.
Basically, you got to change the way soy is being grown by tomorrow. You
know, and, or else.
Or else, right. And I'm like, so I said to Greenpeace, I said, your list of demands, if you really want a solution, we can't change soy farm practicings by ourselves. We don't even know what's going on down there. But if you change your mindset, I bet you we can work together, recruit other retailers to get more of a critical mass of demand. I bet you we can get one of our biggest suppliers, Cargill, who's one of the five big traders in Brazil, on our side, and they're a strategic partner to McDonald's. If we work together, I bet you we can solve this problem. And to Greenpeace's credit, they said yes. So we had three meetings with them in Europe, all within a matter of two or three weeks. And the first meeting we had maybe was a little bit tense, like, do we really trust each other? But before you know it.
Doing the dance, yes.
A little bit of a dance. But once we got to know each other, it's sort of like with the Environmental Defense Fund. It's like, these people are great. They're funny. They're smart. They're caring. I mean, you get to see people way more as human beings. And especially once we agreed that we agreed on the problem and we agreed on a way to go after the solution. So, we ended up splitting up the work like we were a team. Oh, I'll call this person, you call them. Before you know it, we recruited 15 other retailers. I had the president of McDonald's call the president of Cargill, who committed to being a key part of the solution, which was very, very important, by the way. Lo and behold, all this effort of taking a negative campaign and maybe a negative impression of Greenpeace, you know, we turned around, did something. And here's the bottom line. This is the greatest thing of all, is within 3 months, a moratorium was announced by the actual soy traders who agreed with all of our efforts and recommendations. And ever since then, it's been monitored by GPS, et cetera. And basically, there hasn't been further Amazon destruction due to soy.
Right.
Penetration. So, yeah, it's one of my favorites because...
It's one of my favorites too. And here's what's different about your book. I could go on the circuit with you because there's completion. I was trying to put my finger on what is it. So in that same chapter, I loved where you put, and I'm going to read it again, a wake-up call for McDonald's and our suppliers. I hope NGOs reading this book don't think all we need to do is campaign companies like McDonald's, then they'll cave in. A campaign will only be as effective as the truth of the problem it is depicting and the company's underlying practical role in creating a solution. In this issue with Amazon Soy, flexible parties created win-win solutions for all. And think about what you just said. Presidents of some of the biggest corporations in the world, not just the country, called each other and said, hey, let's look at this. Maybe there's something we can do. And the planet was impacted by that conversation. And then many other changes came about. And what your book does, it's like, I want to say in a lot of books, well, then what happened? And if you just keep reading your book, it tells you, well, this is what happened. And is this a perfect segue for another part of the book about Temple Grandin? Because that's a very moving part of the story. And I'm sitting there saying, Temple Grandin, you've got to be kidding. Who knew that she was working with McDonald's? And I'd love you to share that story.
Well, Temple Grandin, yes, probably the most fascinating person and probably the most inspirational person I ever worked with.
Wow.
And I worked on a lot of issues, a lot of time, but she, I just admire her so much. It was, but here's how that began. You know, McDonald's was under scrutiny for use of animals. I mean, obviously, we're a meat company, probably the biggest user of meat in the world. And during the decade of the 90s, a lot of animal rights people were coming after us. And, you know, my boss and I would talk, and we were empty-handed. Like, you know, technically speaking, McDonald's is pretty far removed from the actual management of animals. Our suppliers are people that get the meat in, and they form it into a patty. So at the time, this idea that you're, like, responsible for things all the way down to the where animals are raised, it just wasn't something we were used to doing. And nor did we think it was our responsibility, but we knew we need to change that. I mean, that's been the arc of so many companies over the last couple of decades, taking responsibility in your supply chain. So my boss had heard of Temple Grandin, so he gave me, this is one of my next big assignments. He says, hey, Bob, go meet Temple and figure out an animal welfare program for McDonald's for suppliers. We need something.
You got some really big assignments, Bob. Go figure out an animal welfare program for McDonald's. Yeah.
That's why I like Shelby as a boss, because he gave me broad direction and then he just let me kind of go out there and figure it out. So when I met up with Temple, we went to our first facility together. I just knew this thing was going to be something very special, because she's a very famous person within the animal industry. I'm not sure how many of your listeners know Temple, but please Google her.
And watch her movie.
Ugh. Please watch the movie, Temple Grandin. Claire Danes plays her. By the way, the movie captures her 100%.
I got goosebumps. I got when you said that, because Claire Danes is, yes, that's who I think Temple Grandin is.
It truly is, and it's a 5-star movie. And it takes her work all the way up to working with McDonald's. I think they should make another part two of that movie of her work with McDonald's. So I'm at this facility, and I'm realizing, I'm seeing how the animals are handled. And again, I'm a layperson. I know nothing about processing animals and the design of corrals and the slaughtering process. But the way the people at the facility they're using these electric prods, and almost virtually every animal, can you imagine that every animal was zapped with this electric prod, given a jolt of electricity in order to move it along. And Temple just was so outraged. And she has her own unique style. I call her a whirling dervish. And by the way, that's a compliment.
That's a compliment. I know. And I call myself that. So I think that's a good thing to be. We make stuff happen.
Some people heard that description. They thought that was a negative. No, this is a wonderful thing. She's just so passionate. I mean, nobody doubts her passion and sincerity towards making the lives of the animals better. On the other hand, when we were done with our work, you know, we'd go out and have a steak that evening, believe it or not. So, you know, she wasn't out to destroy the animal industry. She was out to help these animals out. And so she said, you know, we don't need to be zapping these animals. We could be using flags and plastic bags. I can design the corrals to be kind of almost self-designed so animals can walk naturally through without people always, you know, herding them along. And she had all types of other ideas as well. So we basically implemented her animal welfare system, her guidelines. And it took a long time, probably took 3, 5, 7 years for all this to happen within McDonald's supply chain. By the way, globally. And the beauty of our work, again, you referred to it earlier, all this ended up being the norm for the entire meat industry across the globe. So it just wasn't McDonald's work. It ended up, animal welfare became standard operating procedure for everybody with these types of guidelines. So, yeah, Temple always said that there wasn't progress made until she started working with McDonald's and getting the kind of the clout to McDonald's along with her idea. She got more work done in a couple of years than she did the previous 26 years altogether. And it's just so rewarding to work with somebody. That's when you realize like one person can make a difference too. It's like she almost single. I mean, my role was somewhat simple, and I, you know, hey, just try to be somebody that gets her in the right place at the right time. You know, work with the suppliers so they're working with her. But before you know it, the suppliers are partnering with her. They're co-developing programs, and we get these great results.
And here's what she said. Here's what she said. I saw more progress with McDonald's in the industry than all my previous 25 years of work, she said. McDonald's was the heat. I bent the steel. You softened it for me. McDonald's was tremendously influential. People often like to say, if you're big, you're bad. And the converse can be true, too. If you're big, you can be good. And when you are both big and good, you have tremendous influence. And I think that is exactly what happened with McDonald's on this issue. I just don't think it would be where we are today if McDonald's hadn't embraced it. Bam! It's another thing about the book. It's like, well, what did Temple say? And then all of a sudden, just turn the page, and It may be, to me, one of the most admirable, respectful, and impactful changes that they made, because we really do need to care. And it just shocked me. When I turned the page and I'm seeing Temple Grandin, you should see my book. You would crack up. I have like exclamation points and stars and your personal journey to the animal. I mean, books don't get me that excited all the time.
Well, you should have Temple on your show, Gina. There's another idea.
I would love to get her on the show. I hope she's not unreachable. No. I mean, we got Jane Goodall. That's what I always say. If we got Jane Goodall, a lot of people have followed because we have done that. So it's another great story about a big, huge company making a big, huge commitment. And I think that's like one of the big takeaways. I want to ask you about, in your experience, your many years of experience, and through these massive changes, how big a role did the consumer play in working towards some of these big changes versus organizations like Greenpeace and, you know, that were agitating and PETA? Did consumers play a role, or were they just happy campers?
Well, that's a complicated question. So
I like complicated questions.
Let's dig into that a little bit, because the answer isn't all that simple. Because the simple answer is to say that the consumer doesn't want to pay for these things and doesn't put it high up on the hierarchy, especially when it comes to opening up their wallets and making decisions on that. And I would say throughout my history, that's what I've observed, not only within McDonald's and our consumer research, but other companies. It's really tough for people to change and make decisions based solely on this. I mean, cost is so important, convenience, the taste of the food, all that type of stuff. But that's too simple of an answer. It is amazing how the research has always shown for all these decades, Gina, that the consumer really does care. We had a hard time finding non-environmentally friendly focus groups, for example, when we were considering new packaging, because we found virtually almost everybody cares to this to a certain degree. Now, do they care enough to spend more? You know, maybe not. But, you know, if you're a smart business person and you see all this research that says consumers care, and by the way, there's parts of my book where I describe how we monitor brand health. And we had 42 attributes that add up to the brand health of McDonald's. And half of them are corporate social responsibility related. Treatment of people, treatment of the environment, responsibility in supply chain, are you ethical, you know, things like that. So we knew that these were important for our brand. So it's sort of like Steve Jobs, you know, kind of inventing the iPhone, you know, where people asking for an iPhone? I don't think so at that time, but there was a need for that. So I think there's an unmet need here, that there is this demand that's huge, and I still am baffled why more companies aren't going after it, because I think the rewards are really there. Now, if you look at the history of this issue over time, I even say in the book, you know, when we were attacked on polystyrene, the foam, you know, we thought the world was falling apart, but it didn't affect sales at all. And really, all the issues that we've been campaigned about, there's no direct relation to sales, meaning sales today and tomorrow. But I do believe it affects the brand, and those impacts happen in 3 to 5 years, and our brand trust scores were eroded. And so I think it's really necessary for companies to engage in this for those types of reasons. So I think it's a double-edged sword. You know, maybe consumers don't want to pay, but they want it, they expect it. I always thought my job at McDonald's was, and our job at McDonald's itself, was to be the voice of the consumer. So that's another way of answering the question. Because McDonald's represents 70 million people go to McDonald's every day.
Holy smokes.
And the way I think about it is that we represent them. We're their voice. So, you know, they're not asking for bigger cages or a sustainable Big Mac per se, but they're asking us to do good things with the power that we have. And it's up to us to take what they're wanting holistically and apply it to specific things. And that's the power that a McDonald's has and these consumer companies. I believe the consumer retail companies are where the biggest changes are going to come in the near future. Because I know that the consumer does care. Because McDonald's serves every, our consumer research is for everybody around the globe. So I think it's a really potential area for some significant growth.
Well, another area, and it's another perfect segue, of the whole, what I call the Bob Langert experience for me, was I would think that when McDonald's says, we want to change this, the suppliers just say, yeah, sure, because we want your business, because you're like our number one customer. And in your in the book, you really go into exploding yet another myth on the Gina Murphy Darling page. There were lots of battles, and that chapter 6 is the battle for a sustainable supply chain, from silence to sustainable fish, less polluting hogs, and better lives for tomato pickers. I mean, that is a big, big broad stroke. So can you talk a little bit about that? I think people want to know this, because who knew that you source your fish sustainably? I'm allergic to fish, so I don't feel any guilt in not knowing that. So I don't eat any fish. But these are big efforts that I think, I don't even think McDonald's does a very good of telling the story, but oh, I want people to tell the story. I want people to know. And then when I'm driving in there for their fabulous fries, I'm like thinking, hey, I'm supporting a company that is really committed to a lot of things that I'm in alignment with. But talk about sustainable fish, less polluting hogs, and better lives for tomato pickers. Were these things that your boss said, hey, Bob, go find a more sustainable fish and a way to do that for our 70 million customers? Tell us a couple of those stories, because they're great stories.
Yeah, well, you know, my boss retired in 1998, and that was actually an important milestone for me, because now, you know, like I'm the one. I'm more the one now that has to...
The buck stops here.
Yeah, figure out what to do, why to do it, you know, pitch it to top management. So it was an important transition for me. Yeah, the fish story is fascinating. The beginning of it starts with the guy that heads up fish buying for McDonald's. His name is Gary Johnson, smart guy. He reminds me of Bob Newhart from the Bob Newhart Show. And I always thought of him as like an accountant type on buying fish. But he comes to me, he's really worried about the sustainability of fish. This is in like the year 2000. And he wanted to come up with a sustainability plan, and he asked me to help. And we organized we have an annual fish forum meeting with our fish suppliers around the globe. So the idea was we were going to bring in Conservation International and one of their big fish experts, Jim Cannon was his name. And we were going to bring him in there with the idea of asking our suppliers to work together with CI to develop a sustainable fish program. Well, the first reaction from the fish suppliers was, no way, no how. Don't be bringing in some radical group.
Tree-hugging, fish-saving.
Yeah, yeah. But, you know, they're thinking Conservation International is a radical group. They don't even know. I mean, they're not radical.
They're not. They're really not.
But the important part of the story is they thought so, and they didn't want them in. But again, you got to remember, this is about 2000, and McDonald's is getting attacked as being the anti-globalization movement. We had, you know, store windows being broken down in Seattle and Davos and all that type of stuff. So, you know, all this activism of fairly radical nature is out there. So, again, these groups get a stereotype that all these NGOs are crazy. When I think only a small percentage of them are crazy. You know, almost, you know, the vast majority are just fantastic, including Conservation International. Well, Gary stuck to his guns, and we forced the meeting with Conservation International. Long story short, the fish suppliers and Jim Cannon from Conservation International, they become best friends. And they start working on a sustainability fish. They mapped it all out, and they came up with guidelines, red, yellow, green. And, you know, before you know it, we're on the sustainable fish path. And we gave Russia, you know, 3 years' notice that what you're doing up there in Russia is not good, north of Alaska. You're not doing things in a sustainable way. We gave them 3 years' notice. They didn't change. So we shifted all that fish somewhere else. And by the way, we paid, I think, $20 million more for that. Again, didn't tell anybody. And by 2011, this tells you the arc of all these changes. We all of our fish has been Marine Stewardship Council certified since 2011. So that's about a 10-year journey to get from idea to actually making it global and having the fish in our restaurants have that label of Marine Stewardship Council certified. I tell you, when I first saw that happening in our restaurants and seeing sustainability in front of the consumer's eyes on the package, I got goosebumps. I go,
yeah,
this, this is like the zenith of work.
It's a thing. It's a big deal.
Consumer, yeah. Reaching that consumer with it. And by the way, the coffee story for McDonald's, you know, all the espresso coffee is sustainable. McDonald's, this may surprise your listener base. I'd like to know who else in the food service sells more sustainable food than McDonald's with its fish and the espresso coffee. It's starting to work on sustainable beef. So, yeah, you know, big companies can do big things. So that's a great story. And the tomato pickers one, that one's way different.
Way different, but really worth telling.
Yeah, way different and quite surprising to me. I mean, the issue there is this group called the Coalition of Immokalee Workers, and they represent tomato pickers mostly in southern Florida. But as tomato growing goes north up the coast, they represent them as well. And they had a campaign against McDonald's to pay these tomato pickers a penny a pound more per bushel that they picked. And our team didn't want to do it. I was on the team. It was mostly with supply chain people. And again, like I said before, the picking of tomatoes, that's probably three or four steps upstream from McDonald's. You know, we're not involved with that normally. But here we are getting in the middle of it. And I said, hey, it's time for, you know, me to go see what's really happening. Again, not look at it academically, not look at it through just listening to Coalition of Immokalee Workers, and that's just talking to my procurement people. So I went down there. It was just a fascinating visit. And I went down there. I worked with the workers. I picked tomatoes. I walked in that heat all the way to the truck to lift up the tomatoes. And I go, and I'm looking around. I go, you're doing this stuff for 8 to 10 hours a day? You know, I only did it for like an hour or two. And this was hard, hard work. They weren't getting paid much at all. The conditions for them living were pretty horrible. So I became an internal advocate to pay the penny a pound. But I could also empathize. There's people that have read my book in the family going, well, how could the guy in charge of tomatoes at McDonald's, he doesn't come off too good in your chapter because he says we shouldn't give in to these people. If we give in to the Coalition of Immokalee Workers, you know, we'll have people around the street coming after us every which way for everything in our supply chain. And by the way, that slippery slope that he describes, I think there's a logic to that.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
I never looked at John Hayes was the person. I like John. And I thought his arguments for not wanting to do it were good arguments. But it didn't take away my arguments to do it either. You know, so we had this debate going on, a good debate, a professional debate. And supply chain team ended up writing a proposal to our CEO, Jim Skinner, basically saying, don't give in. Let's go with the industry plan, not the Coalition of Immokalee plan. And I was on this team. I didn't sign off on the letter. I got perturbed because I thought it was a misleading recommendation. So I quickly, within a day, worked with some people on my team to produce an alternative recommendation to the CEO that I put in their hands the next day. And the CEO chose to chose our recommendation to pay the penny a pound more. And I never had an experience where the people I worked with in supply chain were so mad at me. They thought I was disloyal, disrespectful, and I had a hard time with one or two people there for quite a long time. So it did hurt me professionally to do that. I still have memories of that, but
you told the truth, and to me that was the transparency part that to me is so important when you write a book like you wrote. That is, people are just going to they're going to bring their own story to your story.
Well, the good ending. Well, two endings to this story. One, you would think that once McDonald's agreed to do the penny a pound for more, again working with our suppliers, it's not McDonald's that hands out the money; it's through our suppliers. The actual tomato to the company that actually is in charge of the tomato pickers, they refused to pass on the money to the workers. They wouldn't do it because philosophically they go, who's McDonald's to tell us what to do?
Yeah.
So this idea that McDonald's can snap our fingers and everything just happens in supply chain, that is a big myth, believe me.
Such a big, big, big myth. And the story, the, you know, you mentioned supply chain and those things that you have to change. And then you have an entire chapter about pigs and gestation crates. And I think that's reflective of how hard it is. You can't, and I hear this a lot at the Green Biz conferences. I hear it at even at Bioneers. Things are not always as simple as it might seem. So there's a plan to help with the gestation crate issue. The Humane Society of the U.S. was involved, but it's like a, what, 8-10 year plan? Because you just don't get all those suppliers to buy bigger crates or get them out of the crates, and people are still demanding the food. That's the part of it. So that's another really, I don't know, meaningful chapter. It's hard for me to read because there are still millions of pigs in gestation crates, which I think is just so incredibly cruel. But there's a plan that's been in place since, what, 2012, I think, if I remember it.
We made an announcement to phase out in 10 years, and that gets into the practicality of it. We felt the same way, our team, myself. I go, this is cruel. This is inhumane. It doesn't make sense. On the other hand, you have to understand the suppliers. This is to change from the old system to a newer system is multi-million dollars of capital investment. They have to go to banks. They have to get loans. So there's a transition period. You want them to make money doing what they're doing. So that's why you end up at some practical viewpoint, because you need to allow the suppliers a transition period, especially with something with so much capital investment as that issue had.
And it goes back to the first R is reduce. And this is the part where the consumer comes in, because there are so many stories. People are buying far less beef. People are buying, they're really buying more cage-free and ethically raised chickens. I mean, the beat goes on. So organic farms are on the upswing. All of these things are consumer patterns that do impact it. And I don't want to eat anything that comes from a gestation crate. I just don't. And I have a choice for that. So that might help facilitate, if the market starts going down for those things, it will help maybe facilitate change a little faster. That's one of the tough ones for me, is about the hogs. But I understand it. I understand it from a business point of view. I don't understand it from the pig's point of view. So let's talk about you. In my opinion, and I say this from full transparency and from my heart, you wrote a great book that's worth the read, The Battle to Do Good, Inside McDonald's Sustainability Journey. As I've said, and I know people will hear why, it's an easy read because there are so many wonderful stories and people want to hear stories, several of which you shared. You're what Mrs. Green's World, we call you a disruptor for good, and we love that. It's high praise. That being said, why did you write it? It was a lot of work. I wrote a book that was a lot of work. It's not even in the same conversation for the book that you wrote and the research you did and the stories you shared. Why did you believe it was so important that this story be told?
Well, you know, one or two reasons for this. In my career at McDonald's, you alluded to earlier in our interview, is that, you know, most people think, McDonald's, what do? They could care less, and they're not doing any good. And I worked on the inside of McDonald's, and the number one complaint we always had is we wish people knew more what we were doing. So I was motivated with the idea that, you know, the things that I went through at McDonald's, this is a fascinating story in my mind, and it's one that I felt needed to be shared. I was the only one that lived through all this stuff. I mean, if I don't tell the story, it's going to disappear.
It's going to die.
Now, beyond that, though, there's a couple other reasons. This idea that all companies are bad and big is bad. And I mean, I don't want to be a super defender of the corporate world. But on the other hand, I do. I mean, I like McDonald's. Everybody I worked with at McDonald's, I thought were fantastic people. Most of all of our leaders, I wish they were my next door neighbors. I told you before, we had an ethical company that wanted to do the right thing. Now, I know most people, you know, they don't believe that, and the almighty dollar is going to win all and profit at all costs, but that was not my experience at McDonald's, and I was on the inside. I saw the real deal. And I thought, you know, rather than people just reading Fast Food Nation by Eric Schlosser, which is the dark side of the fast food business, I want to tell the real story because I lived it. And I think the real story, the honest story, and I wanted my book to be honest and truthful. That's why I interviewed so many different people inside and outside the company. I thought any person that's interested in kind of world and public affairs would find this interesting. And I really wanted to write the book for today's world because I think the leaders that are emerging today, because I think the McDonald's experience, my experience, the people I profile in the book, I think there's a lot to learn there that it can accelerate today's people and it can shortcut what they're doing to be more effective leaders sooner than I was.
And what about the part that, like, you know, you talk about some of these nuances. You know, do people care when they go into McDonald's? And I didn't until I read the book, that you switch from white bags to brown bags and what that means in terms of the environment. I mean, those are things that I think we need to look a little deeper. And maybe everybody listening to the show won't come out as a fan of McDonald's, but they will have respect for all of the efforts, excuse me, and the money that was spent, the sustainability practices that aren't just a CSR report on your website. They are ingrained in the corporate culture, and there are mandates, and there are things that live on, and you're not there anymore. But I think that I felt confident in reading the book that it wasn't just a couple of issues that, you know, Greenpeace made them follow and the Environmental Defense Fund set in motion. It became a part of the values of the corporate culture. Is that an assessment that I am safe in making?
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. And I hope that's how I felt about my time at McDonald's. And I didn't write the book to be I didn't write the book to write a book about how good McDonald's was. I want to talk about the journey, the battle.
And you didn't. It's not a it is not a cheerleading book for McDonald's. That's what I want to say, but it's a battle. It talks about the battle.
I was self-critical along the way with many things internal to the company, but I think there's so much good happening in the world, and I'm part of this Green Biz Network, and you know I rub elbows now with a lot of these companies that are in the Fortune 500. I'm with sustainability leaders, and there's people like me doing the same type of work in many companies, and I think I have a positive view of things. We're not going to get anywhere better unless we're very positive, unless we're very optimistic, unless we are very hopeful. And that's what's going to bring people along. That's what's going to bring the consumer along. I think there's too much in the history of environmental advocacy and sustainability in general. A lot of my education in this area, when I went to training, you know, early on, I'd go to these seminars and conferences. The people talking about sustainability would be talking about how the world is coming to an end and all of that. And I have to say, I would get depressed and unmotivated. So I'm not like that. And I think we need leadership that is much more energetic and hopeful. And we need to turn these issues of where there are problems that we've talked about plenty on this show, and there's many more out there, but we just can't be talking about the problem. We have to see that the solutions are going to help you, me, our neighbors, our kids, and the world we live in.
And I would say that one of the things that's the best part of Green Biz for me, and for people that don't know what Green Biz is, they have a, you know, it's an organization. You can just Google Green Biz and trust me, it'll come up. But they have a conference every year in Phoenix, Arizona, and thousands of people come. And to your point, what I get to see out of it is holding myself in check about easy to jump to conclusions, because you do hear, it blows me away. There's the head of Walmart, there's the head of Google, there's the head of Google Earth, there's the head of Campbell's Soup Company, Target, supply chain for companies that are the big dogs. And They are there being transparent, being authentic, and talking about the challenges that are just not quick fixes. You don't just wave a magic wand. And then you get to hear someone from Beauty Counter, which is so hopeful in the products industry. So Green Biz makes you look at the whole picture and the business side of things, all while pulling in the absolute 100% right direction. Like I said, I have so much respect for Joel McCower. It's scary, and his leadership. So I think unless there's anything that you're going, if we hang up and you say, oh gosh, I wish Gina had asked me that. Are there any of those sitting there in your head that you want to cover one more thing before we get some deep thoughts from Mrs. Green to conclude?
Well, we covered a lot of ground. I guess my only other thought is kind of a theme throughout our discussion is why aren't companies able to talk more about this work? And you know, why does it take a book for me to talk about the McDonald's journey? Why don't companies do this? And I think that ties into the consumer question. So certainly, I think companies are afraid to communicate and market. I think they think they're going to get beat up too much by tooting their own horn. And communicating on sustainability is very challenging. That's why you don't see a whole lot of it. So I hope that's another area that I hope changes over time.
And with your connections and the level at which you're operating and the C-suite access you have, I hope that that's true. I think that's a great way to have some thoughts for you on where this can go. Don't just have it be a book on the shelf about the battle, but listen and be a disruptor for good. So before I close, I want to promote our show on May 21st. Dr. Rupa Marya, Associate Professor, Do No Harm Coalition, Faculty Director, Co-Investigator, the Justice Department of Medicine at UCSF, Health and Justice, The Path of Liberation Through Medicine. It's going to be another one that, like, we heard her speak at Bioneers, and she knocked our green socks off. So here's my thoughts as we close. Our team lives in the reality and with the consciousness that as a planet and in the face of climate change, we have 12 years to make dramatic changes when it comes to our behaviors as citizens or face catastrophic results. Well, I'm one of those citizens. I do my best to live consciously every day. The danger zone for me becomes when I make judgments and assessments, mostly based on feelings about the bad guys, the big bad wolves in the food industry, for example. This book was an eye-opener for me in some pretty pejorative ways. It made me stop to think about the slippery slope of blame and judgment and reminded me that stereotypes and emotional judgments are not the way I want to show up in the world. Bob Langert, the human being, and Bob Langert, the author, changed my opinion about McDonald's big time, and I'm grateful for that. I invite you to press pause for a moment after you listen to this podcast and take your own personal inventory of assumptions you have made or something that might be worth taking a second look at to see if you are spot on or if maybe you need to take a second look. Thank you for being a part of Mrs. Green's world. And Bob Langert, thank you for showing up in mine.
Thank you so much, Gina.